Well, I'm excited. Up through this week, and including this week, we've had to go, because of the schedule, 2 chapters a week. We do that again this week, which means speed talking. But after this week, we have 4 chapters in 4 weeks. So my stress level is cut in half, and looking forward to wrapping it up. Next week, we're going to cover the Day of the Lord, one of the least understood events in church history, or it's really not in church history, but in eschatological history. So often we hear about the coming of Christ, and we just accept that. Well, yeah, Jesus is going to eventually come back, and he's going to kill his enemies, and then, hallelujah, it's the millennial kingdom. And we get that kind of tunnel vision where that's all there is to the Day of the Lord. Everybody's hanging around, it's the tribulation, Jesus is back, and boom. That's all there is to it. The Day of the Lord is called a Day of the Lord for a reason. It's a Day of the Lord. That day will be a momentous day. It will be a horrific day that ends with the great triumph. So really looking forward to that next week. Every time I study the Day of the Lord, that's just a magnificent day. Magnificent. So we look at that next week, but we don't look at it this week. This week we look at the final approach to the Day of the Lord in Revelation 17 and 18. You know, as I was looking through these chapters this week, I was struck that there are a lot of little pithy sayings that you and I have heard a million times in our lives. You know, like, you know, in for a dime, in for a dollar. My dad always used to say that, in for a dime, in for a dollar. Since my dad rarely had a dime and never had a dollar, I'm not sure he really, that was a literal saying. He was just a poor Baptist pastor. It was more like in for a penny, in for a nickel. But, you always hear that. A stitch in time saves 9. Easy come, easy go. And, you know, we hear these sayings so often that we can't really remember when we heard them. I mean, they're just part of our vocabulary. But there is one saying that I will always remember the first time, or at least the first time it registered. And that's the saying that all good things must come to an end. We've all heard that, haven't we? All good things must come to an end. I was in kindergarten when I heard this. It was traumatic. I haven't recovered. I still haven't recovered. But I remember I was coming in from recess one day, and I was passing kindly Mrs. Hornbacker, my teacher, and I made some comment that, you know, I wish recess lasted longer. And she just looked at me very sweetly, and she said, well, Tom, all good things must come to an end. And she went on to the next kid. And that hit me like she had just dumped a bucket of ice water on me. And I thought, that's not true. And then I started thinking about the good things in my life, which when you're 5 years old, there's kind of a narrow, your bucket list is pretty small. But, you know, I thought, well, you know, my birthday comes to an end every year, and Christmas comes to an end. And when I go play with my friends, and there was just this sudden almost panic that Mrs. Hornbacker was right, all good things come to an end. But, you know, as I got older, I realized it's not just the good things that come to an end. That's the bad news. The reality is bad things come to an end, too. All bad things come to an end. All mediocre things come to an end. Everything in this life comes to an end. Today, we look at the beginning of the end of the tribulation. A bad thing from the world standpoint, a great thing from heaven's standpoint. And today we look specifically at the end of 3 bad things. We look at the end of the apostate religion, the global religion of the Antichrist. We look at the end of the false global economic system of the Antichrist. And in that end, we look at the end of the city of Babylon, the headquarters of those 2 systems. And it's interesting to note that as John presents this, and of course John's just presenting what the bowl angel presents to him, and the bowl angel is only presenting to John what God told the angel to. You never forget the hierarchy. You know, while there are messengers used, everything originates with God, so the perspective is always God's. It's important to remember that even though these are just 2 simultaneous destructions, these things happen kind of at the same time, at the same place, God describes the spiritual destruction, the destruction of the spiritual entity first. It's always about spiritual matters with God. God's priorities begin with the spiritual. The physical, the economic, those things come afterwards. With God, it's all about spiritual matters. So today we look at the beginning of the end. we look at the destruction in Revelation 17 and 18, the simultaneous destruction of those entities, false religious system, false economy, and within those, the city of Babylon, which headquarters those things. Now, unfortunately, again, since we're covering so much ground, we don't have time to read chapter 17 and 18, but chapter 17 really details that destruction of the false religious system. Remember, we're talking about Babylon here. John is talking about Babylon. And when the Bible talks about Babylon, it talks about Babylon. We first see Babylon pop up way back in the Old Testament, don't we? And when the Bible talks about Babylon or uses that name Babylon, it really uses it in three different ways. I mean, Babylon, depending on the context, can be any one of three different things. First of all, what can it be? You read about Babylon in the Bible, Babylon's a what? It's a city. Yeah, Babylon's a city. It's been a city for a long time. Babylon, the city, is constructed on what? The ruins of Babel. The ruins of the Tower of Babel. You talk about bad zoning. I mean, isn't that like building on an Indian burial ground? I've seen enough movies to know you don't build on an Indian burial ground. I know all sorts of bad things happen when you do that. Well, you know, what chance does a city have that's built on the ruins of the Tower of Babel? But that's actually where the city of Babel finds its origination. And, of course, it reached the height of its power under what kingdom? The Babylonians. Yes, the Babylonians. You know, we look back in Daniel, and that's really at the end of the power, just when Babylon is losing its power to the Medo-Persians. But Babylon was really the capital city of that portion of the world, and it rose to great prominence during the Antichrist's reign, especially during this last 42 and a half months of the Great Tribulation. Babylon will realize that resurgence. It will once again kind of be the capital city of the world, as it is the economic headquarters of the Antichrist. But that's one use of Babylon. And when the Bible uses it, sometimes it's a city. Sometimes it refers to the economical and social and political kingdom of the Antichrist. Babylon is referred to collectively the entire world government of the Antichrist as it will exist during those last 42 months. So in that standpoint, from that standpoint, it's only used that way within the confines of the book of Revelation. And finally, it's used throughout the Bible to refer to what? False religion. Time and time again, when you see Babylon referred to, it's a reference to some sort of false religion. Really, all false religions. Keep in mind, the false religion of the Antichrist is kind of the culmination of all the false religions that have ever come before it. The false religion of the Antichrist is the perfect false religion from Satan's standpoint. It has just enough legitimacy, just enough trappings of religion to look good, and it's a global thing. So whenever you're reading through Scripture, and that phrase Babylon, that term Babylon comes up, it's always important to say, okay, is this the city of Babylon we're talking about? Is it that global government we're talking about? Is it the false religion we're talking about? And if it's a false religion, are we talking about a global false religion or just the false religions in the Old Testament? Here in chapter 17, we're talking about Babylon. We're talking about initially, the false religious system. Now, John is presented with a vision. Sometimes I think, you know, have you ever watched television or a movie so long that you get eye strain and you get a headache? Sometimes I think, you know, man, if I was John, I'd be getting a headache about this time. John gets another vision. And this vision is so unusual that God, for the first time, just gives the vision and then in the same chapter says, okay, this is what the vision means. Here's different parts to it. It's a strange vision. John sees a scarlet beast with seven heads and ten horns. It's a scarlet beast with seven heads and ten horns. And it's ridden by a woman, grandly dressed, And she's dressed in nice clothes, and she's coming out of a wilderness. That's what John saw. And if you looked out your window and saw this, would you understand what that meant? Of course not. Of course not. And so God stops and explains to John what it means. There is a harlot. It is a great harlot. Not a great harlot, but a great harlot. This is a great harlot. She is coming out of the wilderness, and she's sitting beside many waters, and she rides a beast. She rides the scarlet beast with the 7 heads and 10 horns. So God explains this to John. And since this is the last vision John sees before the day of the Lord, the last vision of destruction, we're just going to break it down. There's a harlot. The harlot is who, according to chapter 17, verse 5? God says it's what? It's Babylon. Yeah, it's Babylon. God says the harlot is Babylon. It kind of takes the guesswork, isn't it? Now you skip down to verse 5, it says here's the name of the harlot. It really takes the guesswork out of it. Now, in this incarnation, like I say, chapter 17 deals with the spiritual destruction, the destruction of the false religion. We know that because everything she's condemned for is a spiritual issue. Now, she has a position. She comes out riding on what? She's on a beast. She's on the beast. She is supported by, she's carried by the beast. And we know the beast is who. That's no spoiler. We saw that in chapter 12. The beast is? No. Dragon is Satan. Dragon is Satan. The beast is Antichrist. So she comes out. When John sees her, this harlot, this Babylon, this false religious system is supported by the Antichrist system. There is some interdependence here. It's a symbiotic relationship. The woman obviously gets the support of the beast, but the beast draws support from the woman as well. She has some degree of influence. Now, remember, during the last 42 months of the tribulation, this false religious system is going to be presided over by who? Who's going to be the pope of the false religious system? No, not the prophet. Not Satan. Not the beast. No. False prophet. The false prophet will oversee this false religious system. The false prophet, it's the false prophet, will oversee this religious system for the last 42 months. And you know, we don't have time to go back, but as we recall, when he first appeared, we noted that his primary objective, in fact, virtually his sole objective, is to cause the entire world to worship the Antichrist as God. He will do so through this global religious system. Now, this religious system will really serve the Antichrist in two ways. I mean, it seems kind of odd, doesn't it? You know, on the one hand, there's this Antichrist, this false god, and yet he wants a religious system. Why bother with a religious system? Why not just be the global emperor? Why not just be that world ruler? Napoleon wanted to rule the world. Did Napoleon want to be worshipped as God? Well, he probably did, but did he ever say it? No. You think of all these people who would go out and conquer. Adolf Hitler wanted to conquer his portion of the world. Did Adolf Hitler, as evil as he was, want to be God? No, he just wanted to rule. So why does this guy, this Antichrist, surround himself with this false religion? Well, let me suggest that this false religion does two things. And remember, who's the Antichrist motivated by and empowered by? Satan. So just as when we look at the visions that John receives and the messages of the angels, we know it starts with God and comes down, filtered through the angels, from God through the angels to John to us. We know that whatever the Antichrist is doing starts with Satan, goes to the Antichrist, and is revealed. Let me tell you, that false religious system will do two things. First of all, it will give the false appearance of spirituality. It'll give the false appearance of spirituality to the Antichrist system. Why is that important? Why is it important to maintain even a false sense of spirituality? It's a spiritual distraction. We as human beings are created with a spiritual nature, are we not? We are created to worship. We are created to exercise a spiritual aspect of our nature. That's one of the reasons why we were created, to fellowship with God, but to serve and worship God. This will provide an outlet. It's a false outlet, but it will provide a natural outlet for that spiritual side of mankind. Mankind will still be engaged in spirituality. They will still be engaged in the exercise of that spirituality. It will simply be misdirected to this global false religion. All right? Secondly, this will create spiritual cohesion within the kingdom. It will create... Do we have spiritual cohesion in the world today? No. And what are some of the results of our lack of spiritual cohesion? How about 9-1-1? You know, you go around the world today and there are constant wars predicated on stated religious differences. You have no spiritual... There are... I can't even tell you how many thousands of religions there are in the world today. You can't even name, because some of them are so obscure that they may be practiced just by a handful of people in a very limited locale. But there are thousands of very diverse religions with very diverse theologies in the world today. And some of those theologies, some of those religions are radically opposed to all other religions. There is no spiritual cohesion. Well, by enforcing one global religion with one global theology, it creates spiritual cohesion. That eliminates all that overnight. Nobody argues about theology anymore. If you live in Los Angeles, California, as it will exist then, or if you live in the Middle East, you have spiritual cohesion because you have the same theology. You're worshiping the same God. You believe, at least in theory, the same things. There is spiritual cohesion. Remember, as we said, man is born to worship. Man loves religion. You know, people always say, well, people reject religion. People don't reject religion. People embrace religion. Mankind embraces religion. Who does mankind hate? Yeah, they hate Christ. They love religion. You give man a religion that caters to his or her felt needs, and people will flock to that religion. Texas is just an absolute great example of that. We have more mega churches in Texas than any other state in the entire union. People love religion. I mean, it's hard to find a church where there is good theology taught, but that's okay. People love religion. They love the trappings of religion. They love the exercise of their spiritual side of their nature. People love religion, and the Antichrist kingdom will benefit. There'll be false spirituality, a false sense of spirituality, and there will be spiritual cohesion within that system. Now, while this system will have some impact on the beast, she rides in on the beast, she has some influence, this system cannot exist apart from the power of the Antichrist. You notice the woman never leaves the beast. The beast can operate independently of her as a realistic matter, but the woman can never operate independently of the beast because all her power and authority comes from the beast. So first of all, she has a position. Second of all, she's dressed to kill. How's she dressed? Tray chic. She's dressed, you know, Charming Charlie. She buys it out. It's stilettos. And obviously, this is a vision, so we know that the woman's garments don't represent, you know, the latest in fashion. What this religious system does, though, is it projects prosperity. This religious system and its leadership will project success and prosperity. Now, we're about 6 years, 11 months, and 2 weeks into the tribulation. Is the bar for prosperity and success going to be a little lower than it is today? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The bar is going to be low. But you know something? Man has a real adaptability. We are able to adapt to our circumstances. And so we envy based on our circumstances. And so when our circumstances change, those circumstances may get much worse. And so we may envy somebody not because they own a private jet, but because they get to eat twice a day. It just depends on what the circumstances are. This church, this false religious system, and its leaders will project prosperity. They will project wealth. Keep in mind, we're late in the tribulation. But there will still be wealth on planet Earth. there will still be wealth. But that wealth, what do you think happens to that wealth? As times get tough, what happens to the distribution of wealth? It's concentrated where? In the hands of fewer and fewer, isn't it? The gap between, even today in good times, even today in tough times, wealth is constantly concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer. There is a smaller and smaller middle class and a grossly expanding lower class. By the time we get to the end of the tribulation, let me tell you something, that wealth is going to be concentrated in the hands of very few. There's going to be virtually no middle class, and everybody else is going to be down there in the pool. Down there in the pool. So the church projects, its leadership projects, not just the false prophet, but those individuals who are in leadership positions in the church. Because remember, the false prophet's not omnipresent. This is a worldwide church. That means they're going to have what? They're going to have pastors, whatever they want to call them, and teachers. They're going to have a hierarchy within that church. And the hierarchy will project health and wealth. And they will, in today's language, drive the better cars. They'll drive the Mercedes of the days. They will live in the mansions. They will fly the private jets. They will eat caviar at every meal. Now, that's in today's perspective. By then, it may be they have a bicycle and they get to eat twice a day and they have enough clothes to wear. Yeah, drive a Yugo. But compared to everyone else, their standard of living will be so much greater than the parishioners that the world will be attracted to that. Because men are attracted first and foremost to the material over the spiritual. Does that sound like any religious system we have today? Doesn't that sound like every religious system we have today out there? Doesn't it seem? Look around. Look around. You go to these churches, and it doesn't have to be a huge church, but the larger the church, the bigger the pastor's home. They live in mansions. They have a fleet of cars. They do fly in private jets. People are drawn to those churches because they see the wealth of the church, or the apparent wealth. They see the wealth of the pastor, the wealth of the deacons, the wealth of the trustees, the wealth of the elders, and they want that. They want that. You know, that's all prosperity religion promises. Is more. Prosperity religion doesn't tell people you can have this much more. Give a dollar and you get $6. They just say, come here, join us, and you will have more than you have. And that's enough. Health and wealth. But it will still be the same prosperity. That's what's chilling. Things haven't changed. The Antichrist takes it to the extreme, but it's still the same. The world will look at the luxury, the projected wealth and health of this church and its leadership. They will hunger for that, and they will plug into that thinking, if I can get into that church, if I can rise up in that church, then I will become what they are. And what they are, you notice, the woman is not evidencing any spiritual values that draw men to her. She's evidencing material values. And the world will look at that and say, I can have more. From a material standpoint, I can have more. Because when the world looks at a church or a pastor or an evangelist and they see vast financial wealth, what do they assume that God's doing there? Not just blessing, because that's true, isn't it? It's approval. The world doesn't make a distinction between common blessing and approval. They look at a wealthy huckster, evangelist, and who is living in a 20,000 square foot house and has a fleet of cars, and they say, God approves of that man. They don't look and say, that guy's getting what he has now. That's the rich man, and that means Lazarus is outside the gate. They look at that as God's approval. And the world will look at that as God's approval. They will equate the financial success, the health and wealth, with God's approval. So she has a position, she dresses well, and she has a name and a job. What's her name? Her name is Babylon what? The Great. That's her name. Babylon the Great. In ancient Rome, when John was writing this, in ancient Rome, prostitution was legal. It was like the Vegas of the old world. But if a woman wanted to practice prostitution in Rome, they had a little truth in advertising system there. And if a woman wanted to practice prostitution, she had to wear a headband at all times when she was in public. And that headband had to specify her name, and that name had to be written in whatever the language was where she was, so that you could tell what it was. And it had to have her job description underneath the name. So, you know, Mary Jo, prostitute. Truth in advertising. Most of the time, records show that those bands were kind of modest. Women would kind of get away with as little as they could. It had to be legible, but you know. But there were also accounts of women who would proudly display those bands. They'd almost have banners across their head, ornate, decorated with gold and jewels, proudly advertising who they were. That's the picture John paints of this woman, of this Babylon. She is Babylon the Great. She is a harlot. She is unabashedly a harlot. What's her job description? Because on her banner, it's Babylon the Great. What comes under that? There's a job description. Mother of harlots and what else? And all sin. That's who she is. That's her job. That's her job title. Isn't that amazing? God makes it very clear that this false religious system, this Babylon the Great, is nothing more in God's eyes than a streetwalker. And her offspring are the sins, all the false religions of the earth, of the entire earth. Why do you think, you know, you and I are never going to see this harlot? You and I are not going to exist under this religious system. Why is God making such a point of this? Who is he making the point for the benefit of? Think about it. Who needs to know this? There's tribulation believers. Because you know something? While they'll be enduring, they will still be possessed of that same nature we are. They'll be still encased in the flesh. And their tendency will be to look at the Antichrist and say, is this God? He does those miracles. That's why God takes the time to lay out several chapters about why this is not God. This is not Christ. He'll be tempted to look at the church and say, this church seems to be getting blessed. Is this God's church? Do I need to be going over there? God takes the time to say, no, this is the harlot. This isn't my church. This is the hooker. This is the harlot. She is the mother of the abominations of the earth. It's interesting that she is called the mother of the abominations, the mother of harlots, and the mother of abominations. Because the truth is, as I said before, she is the culmination of all false religions. And she nurtures sin like a mother nurtures a child. How does a mother nurture a young child? Not my mother. She wasn't that nurturing, but she's not. But not. No. Sydney, don't tell my mom I said that. How do you good mothers nurture your young children? With you feed it. What else? You what? You clothe them. You teach them. You love them. You pacify them. Isn't the truth that when you have a child, if you're a mother, your love, your tenderness, your patience, your thought goes into how you nurture that child. You want that child to grow. You want that child to be strong. You want that child to be successful. That's what Babylon wants for all sin of the world and all false religion. She wants it to grow. She nurtures it like a mother, lovingly. She wants it to grow strong. She wants it to be successful. God says, don't be fooled. Tribulation believers, this is just the harlot. This is just the harlot. There's nothing mysterious about Babylon. There's nothing mysterious about the false religion. She's just a streetwalker, and in God's eyes, she's nothing more than the culmination of all the false religions that's ever come before. It's important that the tribulation saints know this so they don't misinterpret her apparent success with God's approval. She has a broad following. She sits beside what? Many waters. She sits beside the waters. Almost sounds poetic, doesn't it? You can almost imagine this lovely woman sitting beside the waters. Here the waters simply represent the nations of the world. This woman sits. Her influence is global. There is no place on the face of the earth where the influence of this false religion will not go. And in a way, she is like water. If water floods an area, if water floods over a field, Where does the water go in that field? And it goes, but it goes everywhere, doesn't it? Eventually, it hits the lowest point, but it goes to every crack, every crevice, every corner of that field. That's the way that false religion will be. It will be pervasive. And she's drunk. What is she drunk with? She's drunk with the. You know, you look at this woman, and this paints a real picture, doesn't it? A gaudily dressed woman wearing the bandana of a street hooker, who is identified as such, and she is drunk. She is drunk. How many of us have seen intoxicated people? Okay, I'm not going to say how many of us have been intoxicated. I'm going to say how many people have seen. We know what they're out of control, aren't they? They act foolishly. They have no inhibitions. These are the marks of intoxication. She is out of control. She acts foolishly. She acts stupidly. And she's drunk on the blood of the saints. This specifically refers to the blood of the saints during the last 42 months. But in a broader context, to all the saints, all the martyrs of all times. But here, just to those blood. And remember last week, one of the bowl judgments, the third bowl judgment, was turning the what? The water, the fresh water into blood. Remember God said, you're so thirsty, you're so bloodthirsty, drink it. This woman's been drinking the blood of the saints for 42 months. For 42 months. You see, with a false religious system, it's not just about what that false religion promotes. That false religion promotes abomination, sin. But it's also about what that false religion opposes. You've got to remember, there's two sides to every false religion. If it promotes sin, what does it oppose? God and everything God stands for. Righteousness, truth, everything that God stands for, a false religion opposes. So it's not simply, well, here's a false religion, and I guess they're going to go out and try to make some converts, and that's one thing. They're kind of proactive. They are also reactive. They are at the same time opposing everything that God projects, that God values. That's the harlot. That's Babylon. God says to his people in the tribulation, don't forget, she's just a streetwalker. She's a false religion. I don't care how successful she looks. She's nothing more than a tramp. Her day is coming. She's just another false religion. That's the first part of the vision. Well, actually, it's two parts because it's a harlot and the water. And she's on a beast. As we said before, the beast is Antichrist. We saw this guy first back in Revelation 12 when he crawled out of the abyss. He always had the seven heads and the ten horns. But do you remember where names of blasphemy were written when that beast originally came out of the abyss? He had names of blasphemy, but they were written on the heads. They were written on the heads that were on the beast. And that projected the godlessness of the kingdoms that they represented. Here, as the beast is presented, he is written, or there is more blasphemy. Where's the blasphemy carried now? In verse 3 it says, the woman, or the scarlet beast, was full of blasphemous names. The blasphemy now covers his entire body. That tells you two things. First of all, it tells you what? Where's the blasphemy started? Just on the heads. Now it's over the whole body. So what's it done? It's grown. Sin grows. Is that too simplistic a lesson? Isn't that what the Bible teaches time and again? Unchecked, sin will expand. Sin never stops. Sin is never content. Sin is like cancer. Sin is to a spiritual life what cancer is to a physical body. It grows. It continues to multiply until it's addressed. Here, the blasphemy has just continued to grow. It now cloaks this Antichrist. The Antichrist's defining characteristic is blasphemy. I was listening to Tom's sermon today, and I was listening. Somebody heard that. I thought, you know, he said that one of the greatest thing we should give thanks for is the attribute of God of loving kindness, because that, you know, defines everything else and it kind of pours from there. I thought it was very interesting. And I thought, the defining characteristic of the Antichrist, the defining attribute of the Antichrist by this time is blasphemy. And everything flows from there. Sin grows second. Unchecked, sin will begin to define us. Our sin will define us. If we do not address sin, we become our sin. It begins to direct our thoughts. It begins to taint our worldview. It begins to establish our priorities. Sin works its way in, and it's like a computer virus. It shuts down everything. It contaminates everything. This is what's happened with the Antichrist. In 42 months, he's gone from bad, real bad, to absolutely depraved. It has been a journey, and we see the end of the journey. We see the end of the journey in this. Now, he has seven heads. We're not going to take the time because we already looked at it. The seven heads are the what? Yeah, I guess it's that many, isn't it? I was looking at my hand like there should be seven fingers there. No, that's seven. That's seven. The seven heads are the seven world kingdoms. Are they the only seven world kingdoms that ever exist? No, of course not. Of course not. But they're the seven kingdoms that in God's plan with the nation of Israel, God has chosen. Starting with Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, Antichrist. That's on the final. They're the seven kingdoms, that will come, with Egypt being the first one. This final kingdom now, we're at the final kingdom, the kingdom of the Antichrist, and ten horns. We know the ten horns are the ten kings, These ten kings, these men who will rise to power under the Antichrist for the last 42 months. Remember, the world will be divided for that 42 months into 11 political socioeconomic zones. The Antichrist will rule what we know as the Promised Land, north to include Babylon, which still exists there on the banks of the mighty Euphrates. But the rest of the world will be divided between 10 other rulers. Remember, the Antichrist isn't omnipotent or omnipresent or omni-anything, except I guess omni-evil. So he will have to have a hierarchy under him, won't he? He can't rule the whole world. He ain't got the whole world in his hands, not even for 42 months. But he will have a hierarchy. There will be the Antichrist and false prophet. The false prophet will split off and do the false church, the false religion. But those 10 kings will serve as vassals under the Antichrist. 10 individuals ruling the entire earth, each with its own government. But each government will be identical to all the other governments because they'll be ultimately ruled by the Antichrist. That's it. Their support for the Antichrist. These 10 kings, well, first of all, they'll endorse and enforce the policies of the Antichrist. They will not simply agree with them. They will enforce them. And they will enforce them first. The first ones they'll enforce are the spiritual aspects of the Antichrist. They will be the muscle that the false prophet uses to enforce the worship of the Antichrist. They simply won't agree. They won't be passive kings. They will depend on the Antichrist for their power. So they will endorse, but they will enforce all aspects of his kingdom, right up until the sixth bowl, at which time they turn on him and everything breaks loose. And their support will be unanimous. It will be unanimous. Their support will be unanimous for the king. They won't just endorse it, and it'll be complete. These will be absolute disciples of the Antichrist. And you know something? When you get to the day of the Lord, the reason they're destroyed right along with the Antichrist and his forces is because they've endorsed and enforced, and it's unanimous and complete. They deserve the same judgment. They deserve the same destruction. They'll receive it. They'll receive it. Now, you notice it says that these ten horns, these ten kings, will make war with the Lamb. Okay, they'll make war with the Lamb in two ways. First of all, how are they going to make war with the Lamb? Who's the Lamb? Christ is the Lamb, yeah. How are they going to make war? They're going to make war with him two ways. Ultimately, how are they going to make war with him? Day of the Lord, yep. We're going to look at that next week. Day of the Lord. Ultimately, on the day of the Lord, the ten kings will mass their armies there on the plains of Megiddo, 60 miles north of Jerusalem, and in Jerusalem, as they see Christ coming, and they will turn their armaments skyward. They will charge to attack. They will unite with the Antichrist and his armies to defeat the coming Lord. Spoiler alert, it doesn't work. Now you don't have to come next week. All right, I've told you next week's lesson. Jesus comes and everybody dies. Okay. Welcome to the day of the Lord. Now, but the second way in which they do battle with the Lord is the same way people are doing battle with the Lord today, only on a lesser scale. They wage war with the Lamb by waging war with his people. Yeah. They fight the people of the Lord. Persecution. The policy of genocide. Remember, they endorse and enforce. The policy of the Antichrist, one of his policies, is that if you don't bow down to me, if you don't get my mark, if you don't bow down to my image, you die. Well, guess who enforces that? For 42 months, the 10 kings. They enforce that. So they enforce it by ultimately doing battle with Jesus Christ. But for 42 months, they do battle with Christ's people. When you fight God's people, who are you fighting? You're fighting God. That is a lesson that mankind cannot seem to learn. When you fight God's people, you're fighting God himself. And you will face, ultimately, the same God whose people you are fighting. But there's a surprise ending. As chapter 17 ends, there's a surprise ending. All of a sudden, it says, all of a sudden, the kings of the earth and the Antichrist turn on this system. They turn on this religious system. After 42 months of operating under this religious system, they will gather together and turn on the religious system and destroy it. In the end, Satan's kingdom will divide. It will turn on itself, signifying that the end really is at hand. There is no rational basis for this. There is no rationality given for this because there is no rationality. Sin is irrational. You know, when you consider sin, it is, by definition, completely illogical. I sound like Dr. Spock or Mr. Spock. Mr. Spock, very illogical, Captain. And see, I have that same deep voice, too. But that's why I had to tell you it was Mr. Spock. I said, well, who's he? Some of us are old enough to remember the good Star Trek. But it's illogical. Sin is illogical because sin, in its essence, is finite, puny man shaking his fist in the face of infinite God. That is insanity. That is absolute insanity. So to say, well, why would those kings ever turn? Why would they go to bite the hand that feeds them? That's the nature of sin. Sin, if sin goes on long enough, it will always self-destruct. I drew the analogy to cancer. What happens to cancer in the host body, if cancer is unchecked, ultimately what happens? The body dies, and the cancer cells die. It's the same with sin. Ultimately, sin destroys itself. It turns on itself. And that's what we see here. And the entire religious system is destroyed. And not just the theology, but when it's the system, the headquarters are destroyed. They're in Babylon. But worldwide, all the holdings of the church are seized. Look what it says they do real quickly. What they really do very quickly is these kings do three things to the religious system. And again, this is the danger of having to teach two chapters at once. They're going to do three things to it. First of all, they're going to make it desolate. They're going to make the system desolate. They make it desolate by what? What do you take? You take everything the world wanted. You take the land of the churches. You seize the property of the churches. You go to the money of the church. You take everything, all those trappings of success and wealth. You take them. That happens all the time. Well, I won't say that happens all the time, but that's happened repeatedly throughout man's history, hasn't it? I mean, when the Church of England became the Church of England, they confiscated all the Catholics' property in England. Okay? Throughout the Middle Ages, over in Europe, a new ruler would pop up. First thing he'd do is visit the local churches and take all the gold they found. This happens all the time. But these kings will, first of all, strip this false religious system of every vestige of health and wealth that it held out. Second, they'll humiliate her. They will humiliate the whore, the religious system. Humiliate. This false religious system will be rotten from the inside out. I mean, it's founded by the Antichrist and it's run by the false prophet. You know, surprise, but it will be rotten from the inside out. Just as false religions are today, it will be rotten from the inside out. But as is true today, most of the regular parishioners will not realize the extent of the depravity because the leadership will be hiding behind theology and piety and ritual. But these kings will expose the depravity of the rulers, of the leaders, to world view. Do we ever see that today? Yeah. I mean, how many times is a pastor of a megachurch all of a sudden exposed as a homosexual? Have we seen that? And what's the reaction of his congregation? Well, golly, I didn't know that. Nobody knows. You ever notice that? Nobody knows. That's what's going to happen here. But as the depravity is exposed, the whole world will ridicule. She will be spiritually naked before the world. And finally, they'll destroy her. They will not destroy her. They'll destroy her with fire. But the text says they don't just destroy her with fire. They don't just burn her. They burn her up. They burn her up. If we had time, we could go back to the Old Testament, to the law of Moses, which is the law of God. And if you were a witch, or if you made a graven image, you were not simply to be stoned. You were to be burned with fire. You were not simply to be burned with fire. You were to be burned up. You were to be burned until there was nothing left of you. That's the picture here. The destruction is total and complete, till nothing is left. The religious system is in ruins. Very quickly, we look at the economic system of chapter 18 because it is a simultaneous destruction. Keep in mind, the religious system and the economic system are both headquartered in one city, Babylon. So John is describing the destruction of a city of Babylon, which destroys the religious system and the economic system at the same time. Okay, so we're not moving to another location. Chapter 18 describes the destruction. John saw another angel who comes out and announces the destruction of Babylon. This is the destruction of the economic side. Again, the city is down. This is the destruction of the economic side. Keep in mind that this is the destruction of an entire city. This is the destruction of an entire city. It's like, look at one of the great cities of the world today. Paris, Rome, London, New York, Euless. Burned to the ground overnight. Nothing left. What? Oh, I shouldn't have put Paris in there, should I? Burned to the ground overnight till there's not one building standing, not one human being left. And the rationale is for the economic destruction is that she has led the world into sin. Now, did sin exist before the Antichrist? Absolutely. Did it exist through that first half of the tribulation? Absolutely. But here in the second half of the tribulation, there has been a concerted, organized apostasy, if you will. And not just religious apostasy, because there's sin. Sin is sin. But there's also sin in different spheres or venues, isn't there? We looked at the religious sin, the religious apostasy in the 17th chapter. Here in the 18th chapter, it's the sin of economics. You know, you can sin in economics, can't you? You can cheat if you're in business. You can price gouge. There's ways to, you can cheat on your taxes. There are economic, here the harlot has led the entire world. And it sums it up with the kings, the merchants, and the peoples of the world. They have bought into the system, not just into the religious system, but into the economic system. Here's what I want us to really look at in chapter 18. God says, before he ever destroys Babylon, in verse 4, look at chapter 18, verse 4. I heard another voice from heaven, this God, come out of her, my people, so that you will not participate in her sins and receive of her plagues. Before the first match is lit, before the first person dies, God calls for his people to come out of Babylon. Remember, we're near the end of the tribulation. God is issuing a general call to his people to pack up and leave, to get out of the city limits. But it's more than that. To reject her economic system. We know they've already rejected the worship of the Antichrist. How do we know that? Because their God calls them what? my people. So God is talking to tribulation saints. But there are tribulation saints who are still in Babylon trying to fly under the radar. You know, maybe food is a little more accessible in the capital city. Maybe clothes are a little more accessible even on the black market, under the radar, in the city. God says, get out. Because if you don't get out, two things are going to happen. What does it say? In those verses, what does God say? God says, come out, what? So that you will not, what? Participate. The longer we stay in sin, the longer we live among sin, the more likely it is that we will participate in that sin. Poster child for that statement, Lot. Go back to Genesis 17. Lot leaves Abraham. Lot's leading a pretty good life up to that point. But Lot leaves Abraham. By the time the angels go into the city of Sodom to destroy it, where is Lot? Because Lot didn't leave Abraham and go into Sodom. You remember where Lot went when he left Abraham? Hey, he just kind of moved over there. You know, he pitched his tents over there in the plains. And then he moved a little closer. And by the time the angels go into the city of Sodom, where is Lot? He's not just in it. He's what? He's sitting in the gate. He's a mover and shaker. Lot's one of the chief men in the most wicked city in the world. The longer we live with the sin, the more likely we are to participate in the sin because it sears our consciences. We become, you know, environmentally wicked. God says, get out, because if you don't get out, you'll participate in her sins. And then he says, and then what happens next? You participate in her sins and you share in her judgments. You share in her judgments. One of the first lessons, in fact, I suggest the first lesson in the Bible, other than the sovereignty of God and the Creator, is that consequence is attached to conduct. And that is a lesson that is repeated countless times in the Bible. When's the first lesson of consequences attached to conduct in the Bible? Garden of Eden, the fall. I mean, how much more plain does God need to be? There are consequences to conduct. And God says here, you will share in her judgments. You stay in there, you're going to sin. You sin, guess what? When the place burns down, you burn down with it. Never think that you or I are immune from the consequences of our sin. Oh, we are on an eternal basis, aren't we? Thank goodness. But in this life, never think that you or I have some shield of invincibility that protects us from the consequences of our own knowing, deliberate sin just because we call on Christ and claim the name of God. And that's what God says to his people. That's what God says to his people. It's interesting as we close up here. The city is in shambles. And the world mourns. The world mourns. And they mourn. What you all have mourned. I've mourned. The older you get, you're going to mourn. You know? I mean, you know, there's a time when I was young and, you know, you regretted some things and you felt bad about some things. But isn't there a difference between just feeling bad and mourning? Those who have mourned in this room don't need me to explain it. If you haven't mourned, you will, and you'll know the difference. The world will mourn. And when we mourn, what do we mourn over? Things we what? Things we love. Things we value. Things that are high on our priorities. Things that we hold dear. The world will mourn the destruction of the economic system of Babylon. The most wicked, vile city that ever existed in the history of mankind. That's a really poignant statement on the heart of mankind. By the end of the tribulation, what man will value most is what God hates the most. Mankind will look at the false religious system. They won't mourn over that. In chapter 17, they didn't mourn. But when they look at the economic loss, they mourn. They don't mourn over the lives lost. What God values most, man values least. They mourn over lost economics. If we had time, we'd look at how they mourn, because they mourn three ways. I want us to think about this real quickly. As the world stands looking at the destruction of Babylon, the world mourns, and they mourn in three ways. And I suggest to you today, if you think about it, these are the same three ways the world mourns today. And when I say the world, I'm talking about every unsaved individual when confronted with the reality of the end of life. either their life or someone else's. First of all, they mourn in isolation. The text says that from afar off, they each mourn. They mourn individually. Grief, mourning isolates us. It isolates us spiritually. It can isolate us spiritually. It isolates us emotionally. It isolates us physically. And the world mourns in isolation because apart from God, there is no bridge from the grief to anyone or anything else. I'm telling you something as a Christian, that's still a reality with you and with me. When you find yourself grieving, don't be reluctant to accept the comfort of others. That's why God sends them around. But they mourn in isolation. They mourn in fear. They mourn in fear. They fear to come near to Babylon as it burns. Why do they fear to come near? Because what? Same thing might happen to them. The same thing might happen to them. They're afraid of it. Apart from God, apart from an absolute certainty of salvation, the end of a man's life holds nothing but dread and fear. And every time they see someone else come to the end of their life, they are being reminded that that will happen to them too. And their mourning is not just for that dead person. Their mourning is for their own fear and their own dread because they have nothing. They have nothing. And finally, they mourn in hopelessness. They say, Babylon is gone, never to return. Man's mourning apart from God is always hopeless because there is no hope beyond the grave. Realize apart from Jesus Christ, there is no hope beyond the grave. There is fear, there is dread, there is judgment, there is never hope. That's how the world will mourn Babylon. That's how the world mourns today. That's how the unsaved world mourns today. But you know something? All bad things must come to an end. Babylon is destroyed, but that's just a day trip for the kings of the armies of the world. They turn their attention to the Antichrist. They move south into the Promised Land. They set up camp on the plains of Megiddo. We're about 2 weeks away from the day of the Lord. That's where we pick up next week, the day of the Lord. So what does this say to us? Well, just a couple things quickly. God calls for his people to come out of Babylon, to come out of her city limits, but even more so, to come out of her value system, to come out of her priorities, to come out of her economy. You know, that's the same call that God makes today and always has been. God has called his people to come out of the world. Obviously, we can't leave the world. We're in the world. But what God calls us out of are the world's priorities. God says, don't be taken in. Don't have the same values as the world. Value what I value. Put spiritual matters first. Don't look at the economics of things. And prize those economics above all things. Reject the social mores of the society around you. God says, come out. That is a continuing call. That call has more urgency for those in Babylon. But you know something? That's a call for you and me. Because if we stay within the world system and we do not recognize the difference between the world system and the world's values and God's system and God's values, you know what's going to happen to us? We will participate in her sins, and we will share in her judgments. Consequences attached to conduct. Consequences attached to conduct. And second, I'm always struck by the way the world mourns. Because the world mourns then as the world mourns now. In isolation, in fear, and in hopelessness. You know, part of salvation is not just that we are saved from eternal damnation, thank goodness. But part of salvation is that we don't have to mourn in isolation, fear, or hopelessness. Instead of isolation, we have the comfort of the Holy Spirit and the comfort of other believers. Instead of fear, we have confidence in God and in his plan. And instead of hopelessness, we have the assurance of what comes beyond the grave. The holiday season hits mourners hardest. As people go through the holidays, those who have lost loved ones tend to have a more difficult time. Depression is up. Suicide is up. Alcohol consumption is up, and it's not simply because, oh, everybody's partying. The holidays are a difficult time for all who have lost, but most especially for those who mourn apart from Christ. As you encounter those people in these holidays, this next 2 months as we go through it, be aware that part of what Christ offers is freedom from hopeless mourning. Remind them of that. It's part of the plan of salvation. There is an option to hopelessness, fear, and isolation. The option is Jesus Christ. Next week, we look at the day of the Lord. Let's close in prayer. And Lord God, we thank you that you have removed us from the isolation, fear, and hopelessness of mourning. That in you, Lord, there is no isolation. You always draw us to you. That in you, there is no fear, for we have confidence in you and in your plan, and there is no hopelessness, because, Lord, we have not just hope, but we have a guarantee of what comes beyond. Lord, may we be quick to offer that same gift to those who have not received it. Lord, even as you called your people in Babylon during the end of the tribulation to come out of her, Lord, we're mindful that we live in a world, but we do not have to live in its value system. Lord, may we consciously make the distinction between the values of the world and the values of the kingdom of heaven. And Lord, may we consciously make those our values. May our priorities be realigned to meet your priorities. And Lord, may you find in us good and faithful servants. We pray this in